The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming for your day two of the workshop, Legal Skills for International Public Interest. We have our guest speaker today again from yesterday, Ms. Christy Edwards, who is director of the International Humanitarian Law Office at the American Red Cross. She will be presenting today on monitoring and evaluation, and she has some handouts, so please take one of each. And then later today, we'll be joined by our second presenter, Mr. Eric Goudrier, around
About
3:15. Without further ado, I'm going to give the mic to Christy.
I'm actually going to use this one, so maybe for questions, sure. We can use that one. So hopefully the mic is going to pick me up on this. For those of you who are listening, so hopefully the mic is going to pick up for those of you who are listening to the podcast, and thanks so much for joining me again today. I wanted to first give you guys an opportunity to ask any questions about the materials from yesterday. I know particularly for some of the Excel spreadsheets, it's a little maybe complicated, and if you've never seen something like that before, it can be a little daunting, but certainly, if you have questions, I wanted to give you the opportunity to ask anything that you might have thought of last night or wondered. I know the print is rather tiny on those, so
yeah.
Apologies. Okay, so if there are no questions, then we'll move on to the first of today's topics, which is monitoring and evaluation. If you're just joining us, if you want to grab one of the packets, one of each of the handouts on the table.
Thank you.
Actually, we'll give it a moment since there's a couple people joining us. Hopefully they can edit this out. I just had asked if anybody had any questions from yesterday. I know that some of, especially the Excel spreadsheets, were a bit complicated and minute in print. So if you had any questions, I wanted to make sure you had the opportunity to ask anything that might have come up for you or that might have been a bit complicated. Yes, Chelsea.
Question about the program budget detail. So I know it says it's detailed, but it also doesn't break things down. And I was wondering, just in general, do you normally populate that through separate Excel sheets where you keep track of, you know, everything that would go into lodging for one of your for staff travel? And does you then use that when you are preparing your final report to actually break this down even further and go into like more detail than the program budget detail?
So the program budget detail, this is actually something that you would keep track of for reporting purposes. When you get, hopefully, you know, assuming that your finance team is giving you accurate details, when you get a BVA, the budget versus actuals, remember how I said that that the overall sheet that I got? So the sample BVA document, it's a monthly accounting of where you've spent in all these categories. This is one of like 13 sheets that I get. So I get some that are really, really high level, like literally if I have two buckets of money for my entire team, how am I spending overall? If I've spent, you know, $10,000 out of a million, I know I'm kind of in trouble. Or if I've spent $200,000 out of a million, maybe that's, you know, on par with where I should have been for that point in the year. Some of the other tabs that I get or other handouts from my finance team go into exact detail. So every single expenditure for that month by anyone on the team for anything, and then it shows me under what category it fell. So that's where I would be able to check to see if the LAC team is, you know, charging a bunch of flights and I work on the Africa team. You know, I would be able to see at that point that that's an incorrect detail and they would need to move that charge over to the correct budget. So the BDA document that I've handed out to you is not the only thing that you would hopefully get. And this is something that you could then use to track or plug some of these numbers into this high level. So when you see the actuals through 2010, 2011, 2012, these numbers that you're getting in your BDA is where you're going to pull that information from. Because this kind of gives you just a sum total. It's not going to give you the every single expenditure that you've had in the past month. Does that make sense? Okay. And again, all of these tools are supposed to work together. They're not supposed to be duplicative, but they are supposed to hopefully integrate and give you different pieces of information so that you're tracking your money appropriately, you're tracking your spending appropriately, and you're tracking how fast you're spending your money. Because if you're really, really underspending, again, that might mean you're trying to spend $200,000 in the last month of your program, which is really hard to do. Or if you're overspending and then you have no money to pay salaries in the last 2 months of your program, you're also in trouble. So this just, all of these tools, the BVA, the budget detail, the burn rate tool, those are just ways for you to accurately track what you're spending. Okay, any other questions? All right, great. Let's get started on today's packet. Hopefully you all got a packet when you walked in with all of the examples of documents that we're going to cover today. Okay, it's blue and pretty on the front. All right. So let's say you've won a USAID proposal and you're going to do economic development in several countries in Africa. This is actually a sexual and gender-based violence project example, but this literally could be used for any number of topics. This is not specific to one sector or kind of work that you have to do. It's just an example of how you're going to capture the information. So this is something that you would put together when you're applying for a grant, but then also use it to track how you're doing in accomplishing the goals that you've set for that program. So let's start at the top. First is the overall goal. What is the whole point of your program? What are you trying to accomplish? What is the task you're trying to achieve? Remember yesterday when I was talking about the proposal. You're going to talk about the need. Why is this even relevant? Why are you doing this work? And what are you hoping to achieve at it? It's kind of like IRAC for lawyers, you know, explaining why you're doing the work that you're doing and simplifying that in a goal statement up at the top. Then your objectives. It's best to have 2 to 3, sometimes 4, any more than 4 gets really complicated. Objectives. What are some of the exact objectives that you're trying to accomplish? So here, this organization is going to provide emergency assistance to individuals facing extreme acts of gender-based violence, including harmful traditional practices, provide prevention and protection assistance to human rights defender organizations or individuals who are working to address SGBV, and provide a focal point for improving SGBV regional and international network. So those are the three overall goals of what this whole grant is supposed to accomplish. So understanding all of the work that's going to be done over the next year or 3 years or however long they're going to be doing this is to accomplish these three goals, these tasks. Next is the impact. Why do you want to... Let's go down to the bottom. So underneath these objectives and the goal, you've got activities. It's the very last box, line of boxes at the very bottom. kind of a light blue box. So underneath each one of these objectives, you've got activities. You're going to have applications available for people to apply for emergency funds. You're going to provide several kinds of services to people who are applying for those kinds of funds. You're going to apply or provide assistance in various sectors for those people. And that also all falls under the providing emergency assistance to individuals facing threats of SGBD or SGBD themselves. Under the provide prevention or protection assistance, all of the activities there support directed advocacy campaigns and facilitate preventive security and protection workshops. Those all go towards the goal of provide prevention and protection assistance. And then finally, in order to create a focal point or provide a focal point for improving SGBB regional and international networks. Sorry, the mic is fading in and out here, sorry. The activities would be to coordinate the network of partners and advisors, begin discussions of advocacy objectives regionally and internationally, and then to plan joint coordinated advocacy initiatives. Okay. Hopefully between both microphones we'll capture it. Perfect. Okay. Any questions on this so far? Does this make sense as far as how you're going to capture this information to show your donor this is what you're doing and this is why? Okay, great. So then we come to outputs and outcomes. This is what confuses a lot of people because they sound similar, people aren't quite sure what the difference is between the two. Basically, it's the difference between qualitative and quantitative information. So under outputs, that's where you're going to measure the numbers, the quantitative piece of it. You're going to have this many grants that you're going to give, you're going to host this many workshops, you're going to assist this many people, you're going to form partnerships with this many organizations. It's literally just how many people, how many bodies did you have in a room, how many dollars did you send out, how many wells did you dig, how many people did you train on how to start a new business, anything like that. It's just the numbers. But then there's also the qualitative piece, which is the outcomes. You're not just putting people in a room and giving them a training on something for the heck of it. You want it to be for a really good reason. You want them to be able to continue this work in the future. So you're going to look at outcomes as well. So again, if you're providing money to people that are facing threats of gender-based violence, you want it to actually help, right? You don't want them to just take the money and go back to their home and still face those threats. You want that money to actually accomplish something. So you want them to be able to either escape, take that money and buy a plane ticket to go somewhere else, or hire protection services. Maybe they need a security guard in front of their office, so that money is going to help provide the security resources that they need in order to continue to do their work. So under the outcomes, you're going to put what the whole point of giving that kind of assistance is. You're training people on how to start a new business. Well, you're hoping that because of that, new businesses will actually start and it will improve the economic ability for women in that community to sustain themselves and their families in case of either disaster or armed conflict. Whatever it is, there's supposed to be a point to the numbers of people that you train, the money you give, the partners you've created, et cetera.
With some sectors, it's easier to show or to evaluate. Mm-hmm. For example, health, okay, I provide vaccines for, I don't know, 100 children, something like that. Maybe training for how to initiate an enterprise or something, you have numbers to show. Mm-hmm. But in education, how you show I improve the quality of education in Zambia, or how you show quality, how you show, I don't know, because it's not just build a school, because they already have a school, mm-hmm. they already have teachers. How you improve the teachers, how you show, how you measure these kind of things.
And that's where the having both qualitative and quantitative data is really important. So yes, there might be a bunch of schools. But if you're in Afghanistan or Pakistan and girls can't go to school, then it's really impossible to measure the literacy rates of girls because they can't go to school. Or maybe they can if they're being tutored at home, but it's really hard to get those numbers. So you probably want to measure what's the percentage or numbers of girls versus boys attending school, how many years do they go to school, are they being tested on their literacy rates, to what level of education? Do they go to through primary school? Do they go to secondary school? Do they go to university? If they do go to university or even finish secondary school, do they get jobs? Are they jobs in the informal sector, working at home or on their family land? Or are they in the formal sector? Do they go to work at a bank or for a business? Do they start their own businesses? So there's lots of different things you can measure, even if it's kind of difficult. But you can also do, there's you can do interviews with people. You know, you and we're going to talk about evaluations in a second. But there's a way to capture the numbers of what people are learning, and then also get some feedback as to, is this the best way to be training people, to be providing assistance, to be giving aid? There's lots of different things. And so this is just a kind of a high level, here's what we're trying to accomplish in our grant over the year. But then the evaluations is where you really get into the nitty-gritty of, is this working? How can we see the shift over time of whether or not it's working? And if you're not seeing a shift, then maybe this is not a good, this is, you know, it's a good framework. Maybe it's not the best. Maybe our logical assumptions about what we're trying to accomplish are incorrect. Maybe we have a bad framework and we need to change it. But so the evaluations that we're going to talk about in a minute are ways to help us capture that data. But this is a tool that just helps us know overall where are we going and what are we trying to achieve with the program. Does that answer your question? Any other questions on the log frame? And by the way, someone with really amazing Excel skills did this. I did not.
I just have a question because it kind of looks like this would be the first step then in any project development. Yeah. And I just wanted to make sure that this is typically what you do before you do anything else. Mm-hmm. Before you look for fundraisers or anything like that, you're creating this log frame.
Yeah. This is what was developed when I put together, I worked with a team to put together a proposal. This is what we submitted to the State Department to say, this is a project we want to do. We went through the narrative part that we talked about yesterday, identifying the need. We know that there's a ton of people, human rights defenders and organizations, that are threatened with sexual-based violence. So we identified the need. Then we wrote out, it was like a 15-page document, how are we going to address those needs in those particular areas, because each region in the U.S., or not sorry, in the U.S., in the world, has different threats that they're facing and different problems that they're encountering. So we talked about each of those regions. We talked about the organizations, what capacities they bring to the table. You know, why is it great to have one organization that is an international organization that kind of supervises everything at a high level, and then regional organizations that implement where they are most effective, and then another organization that is literally able to distribute money. So there were five organizations that applied for this grant, and we explained why each of those are really good at doing what they're doing. But this covers everything. All five of these organizations are trying to accomplish everything in this log frame. This is the overall goal, the whole organization, or the whole grant. And then when we're talking, you know, in a minute, we talk about how do we actually do these? How do we capture these numbers? You know, number of applicants receiving immediate assistance. Well, that's going to be a whole other tool to make sure we've got the numbers we're hoping to get, right? Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank
okay.
You.
All right. So again, this is what you submit at the beginning. Then once you start implementing, I think one of the best. I mean, you can go in and not measure where people. Let's say you're doing an education project. It's kind of hard to measure how successful you are unless you know how many people can read at the beginning. If you're trying to improve literacy rates for boys and girls in Namibia, but you have no idea how many people can read, let's say you've just heard tangential evidence that it's a problem. But you don't know if it's 20% or if it's 50%. And you don't know how to measure your success unless you do a baseline survey. So this is an example. This is a different kind of project, but again, the subject matter doesn't matter. It's just that we're looking at the mechanism here. You're going to go in and you're going to ask questions, maybe do some testing, get a sample number, and try to figure out what is that number? Where are you starting at? So you know, if you're at 20%, you've got a lot of work to do. Hopefully you kind of have an idea before you've applied for that proposal. But this will give you much more specifics on where you're at on the kind of program that you're trying to implement. If you're at 50%, or maybe you're even at 70%, you have less work to do, but you still need to do more. Maybe you need a little bit more of a nuanced approach because they're doing okay, but they could do better. So this helps guide what you do in your activities because you've got a baseline survey of where things stand. And again, this applies across all sectors. If you are trying to figure out how to bring better access to water to a desert community and you know that there are 3 wells within a 100-mile radius, and you know you need to maybe have 100 wells, then you know your ability to dig those wells is going to be drastically different than if there are 50 wells and you want to build 50 more. Does that make sense? Okay. So this is just, again, baseline survey. In this project, we were trying to ask or to measure 3 different things. We were trying to measure knowledge of a specific topic. In this case, it was international humanitarian law. Attitudes and behavior. You don't have to measure all of those things. We were because our goal for this program was to increase the knowledge, attitudes, and behavior because we think, you know, it's great if people know about IHL, but if they just know it and go on with their day and that's nice to know and that changes nothing about their daily life, I don't particularly think that we've been all that successful. If we've changed their attitude as to what, yes, okay, now I know what the Geneva Conventions say, but I also think that it's drastically important for people to know that IHL is part of our daily lives and how we're supposed to respond to that, that's going to then shift our behavior. So let's say, okay, now you've been trained on what the laws are. You now think it's actually important to know about IHL, that's going to shift your behavior because now maybe you're going to go out and sign an advocacy campaign. Maybe you're going to lobby your congressperson to do a better job of implementing the Geneva Conventions when we go and drop bombs on ISIS or ISIL in Iraq, you know, making sure that we uphold the Geneva Conventions when we do that. And you want to make sure that your representative knows our responsibilities under that and you know, acts accordingly when they approve that that action by Congress. Maybe they start to volunteer or donate money to organizations that are working with refugees to make sure that those people are given adequate protections and support. But maybe let's say their attitude is, I don't think that this is too particularly important. Okay, it's good for us to know because then if there's no shift in behavior, we know it's because they don't think it's particularly important. They now know, yes, we're going to abide by the Geneva Conventions, but that's all I need. It doesn't matter whether you know it or not. So then when there's no behavior shift whatsoever, we understand why. Again, that's not going to apply to every kind of project. Maybe all it is you're trying to increase someone's knowledge of domestic violence law or a labor law, particularly for rule of law type of programs. The ABA Ruley has fantastic programs out there. Maybe you're just trying to get judges to be aware that there is a law protecting LGBT communities in their country. So you might not ask some of the attitude and behavior questions. I personally think if you're trying to shift implementation, it's a good thing to include, but you don't have to. If you take a look, section 1, this is where we just measured knowledge. So we asked a couple questions, not really hard ones, but some questions about IHL, asking them to identify the correct answers about some general principles there. And then in questions six, starting on the third page there. Question six, that's how do you feel? That's the attitude questions. How do you feel about the following topics? And again, remember this is a pre-survey question. We also try to capture some demographic information, understanding male, female, age group, et cetera. You can measure race, population, level of education, geographical regions, et cetera. That was just basically for us to kind of get an understanding of maybe where are people more or less interested in these subjects and who are they? Why is it that some groups have more knowledge or awareness of something and maybe others don't? Particularly in capturing gender disaggregated data, especially in a lot of human rights and humanitarian contexts, getting gender disaggregated data is really, really important. Because if you're only asking men these questions or if you're only asking women these questions, your results might be skewed. It's really good to have a good sampling of both men and women. So then the next survey tool is the POST program. So they've now gone through a whole year of programs. They've gone through lots of trainings. They've gone through quite a few activities, webinars, conferences. Let's say you've just given them a slew of information. You have rocked their world. You've got a bunch of judges in Morocco that now are totally sold on the fact that they think that there should be a domestic violence law for women in Morocco, or men and women, actually. It's both have issues with that. So you want to now ask them, all right, can you explain what domestic violence is? Can you explain what IHL is? And so you're going to ask those same knowledge questions. Can you identify correctly what this area of law is, or this legal principle, or this topic? So that you can see whether or not they actually, you know, now that you've given them a year's worth of programming, did they actually get it? Do they understand what it was that you were trying to train them to do? So there's quite a few different knowledge questions there. And then question number six again, how do you feel about the following topics? And so you'll actually, these are actually the results, the pre-program questionnaire. I just showed you the questions. Not the results, but as you go through the post questions, see that the numbers are pretty good. You know, people actually do know what it was we were hoping that they would come out with. And even on the how do you feel, the numbers are pretty high. The lowest number there is 81% of people that think that it's important that the U.S. follow the rules of war as a part of the Geneva Conventions. Frankly, that's probably a lot higher than the general population. Actually, I know that that's quite higher than the general population, and that's what we were hoping that people would do. And so when we look at the year, we'll compare the numbers, the percentages of people from where they were before to where they were after. And that difference between the two is what we say we've changed. So when we're reporting to our donor, we can say we've improved the rates of knowledge and understanding of what the Geneva Conventions are by 15%. Or we've improved the literacy rate among girls in Zimbabwe by 20%. They were 20% before, now we're at 40% in 1 year. That's a drastic improvement. Or there were 3 wells in this community last year. Now with all of this work, there are 27. And so we've improved that number by 24 wells. So then you can go back to your donor and say, we were successful, at least in the numbers, right? So again, remember that difference between the outcomes and the outputs. That's where you're going to measure that quantitative data. Now the questions about feelings, attitudes, and behavior, that's where the outcomes are going to come from. How do you feel about it? How did this impact you? Do you feel safer? Do you have the ability to have clean water? Are your communities healthier because you have access to clean water? Because of you've had so many vaccinations, are fewer children dying? Yes. Are the rates again? Those number questions. Those are going to be the outputs. But if people are more, you know, if greater populations or greater numbers of the population can read, does that mean that you've got better income rates within a given community because more people have access to credit and jobs and maybe start their own businesses, and so the economic wealth of any given community has risen? That might not be something you're going to measure in 1 year, but maybe over a 10-year period, that would be something that you would really want to take a look at. But again, that's the outcomes part of this. Any questions on this so far?
So, like, usually how do you distribute the survey?
Excellent question. My favorite tool is SurveyMonkey. There's other ones out there, but I love SurveyMonkey. Number one, it's free. Number two, it has lots of cool buttons and it's pretty. It gives you little lovely charts and things that are very visually appealing afterwards. I would say, you know, for anybody that's interested in this, go on and play. You can start your own account. It's free. Go out. You can even copy these questions and play with the font, you know, the font sizes, the buttons, whether or not you want to, you know, have buttons going left to right or up and down. It's a great thing to get accustomed to because you can build this quite easily. Now, you'll notice all the evaluations that I did with you guys yesterday and today, those are on paper. I'm going to go home and I'm going to probably ask one of my interns, not Chelsea, to type that up for me, maybe plug it into a survey, put those questions into SurveyMonkey. So because I didn't have your email addresses before you came, maybe next time I will ask for those email addresses so that I can email you one. It's a link, an embedded link that you would send out, and people just click on it. It captures that person's data only, and it can be anonymous, or you can ask for their name just so that you can follow up, and you can capture the information that way. So it depends on, you know, if you're in a rural community with and nobody has computer access, giving them a SurveyMonkey link is not going to be helpful. If you are doing a training in Germany, you can probably do this on your phone. and there's lots of ways to capture that data. Sometimes, maybe even for people that are illiterate, you might have to actually have, and I actually worked on a project in Egypt where most of the respondents were illiterate. So we hired survey takers, professional survey takers, to go out into these communities and ask them the questions and to capture their answers. And again, it was, you know, yes, no, maybe, or to, you know, a scale of 1 to 5, how do they feel about certain things? And then there was a piece where we asked them, if you could ask the new constitutional committee for Egypt to put things in there, what do you think is most important to capture in the new constitution? And they said, well, I think that the new constitutional committee should do X, Y, and Z. And we asked 1,000 people, what do they think are the most important priorities to put in the new constitution? And then we put it all, you know, the people came back from the field, typed up all those answers, and we put it into a big fat report. It was much bigger than this. It was like 100 pages long. So then when this group of women that I was working with actually went and made a presentation to the Constitutional Committee, they said, we've surveyed 1,000 people, and these are the top priorities that they think you should include when you're drafting the new Constitution. And that carries a lot of weight. That's a really great tool to be able to say, even if somebody can't fill out a SurveyMonkey, you know, we've captured this information, both qualitatively and quantitatively. Any other questions? And again, some of the biographical data, if you want to be able to follow up, if you're trying to figure out which age groups know maybe more about this or have access to these kinds of tools, some of that can be helpful. It might not be relevant to you, so you might not want to get it. I do typically advocate for gender disaggregated data because, again, it's a great way to see whether or not those groups are getting equal access to information. Or resources. All right. I know that's kind of a lot. I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a break. Oh, yeah.
So I guess it's all about research. But what happens if you actually do a research in a rural area and you identify a need in this area, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you develop a proposal which includes a budget and whatever proposal involves. But you perform this survey, and at the end you find out that these needs are not as strong, probably, as in another country where you have already done another research.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that my question is there a way you can, as a grant requiring institution, is there a way you could say, like, we believe that we got this grant, but we believe that this area has more needs. Can we switch these funds to this new project instead of this one? Or probably that won't happen because you, by the time you have performed the service, you have already invested too much time, I guess, already in the project.
I don't know.
You're not going to like my answer, but it depends.
Okay.
I worked on...
You get that a lot in the legal field.
Yeah, I worked on a project once. It was a state-funded grant, mm-hmm. and it was working in the Middle East and North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And literally we started this program 2 weeks after the Arab Spring started. So there were a lot of shifting pieces, a lot of political turmoil
right.
in all of the countries. So we won this big grant. It was to work in 10 different countries. Well, because of what was happening in the Arab Spring, there were some countries, like the UAE, I think, you know, they actually just kicked out almost every single NGO in the country. They wouldn't allow you to even work in the country. So we tried and we tried and we tried and we tried and we tried. And eventually, and we kept our donor in the loop. We talked to them about every step of the process, letting them know what difficulties we were facing, what new tactics we were trying, and they were very collaborative with us in that process, putting us in touch with resources and people that they knew of, connecting us with other grantees that were working in the area, to try to figure out how we can best implement this grant. At the end of the day, and it was about halfway through the implementation period, we came up basically against a brick wall. And we went back to our grantor and we were like, look, you know, these are all the 27 different things we've tried, and it is not going to work here. Bahrain, UAE, you know, there's a couple countries here. We're just not going to be able to implement. However, we've been doing some assessment surveys in Tunisia and Algeria where there is a bit more openness. We have really good contacts there. We would be able to implement this program and do it on an expedited timeline because we know we've only got half of our time frame left. So we need to be able to implement something quickly. And so here is our proposal for how we're going to implement this and change it and do it in different countries. And so we went back and forth, and eventually they said, okay, let's try that. And then when we did our final report at the end of the whole grant period, we just explained that in detail. Again, donors are not unwilling to let you change things or even say you quote unquote failed. I know people are really, really scared of telling their donors that they've failed. Sometimes you just can't make something work. You've had the best intentions, you've got the best research, you've done fabulous assessments, and something happens. There's a coup. You know, the president's kicked out. They've changed the law, and now they no longer allow NGOs to even operate in the country. Something happened, and you cannot implement the way you thought you would. Explain that. And don't put it in your final report and let your donor hear about that for the first time then. Keep your donor in the loop the whole time, and so that when they get your final report, none of it is news to them. This is more of a way for your donor to either show Congress or their board of directors what has happened, because your board of directors and Congress have not been following every step of the way. But they need to be able to show a written document at the end to say, this is what happened, high level. And they're going to know the nitty-gritty. They're going to know all 27 things you tried, you know, to be able to work in Bahrain and why you had to shift and now maybe implement in Tunisia instead. Any other questions? Okay, I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a break. Let's come back in 15 minutes. I also wanted to give you some time to read over these survey tools because it is quite a bit of information, so I want you to be able to take a look and have some time to ask questions about any of these things afterwards. Okay, great. Why don't we start with question? And welcome if you've just joined us. we're happy to answer questions in a little bit because I'm sure you probably have some if you're just now looking at this information for the first time. But did anybody have any questions about the survey tools? It was brilliant, very clear. Everybody got it. Okay, great. Not every organization will have an advocacy component, but many organizations will do some sort of advocacy work, whether here in Washington, D.C., or maybe with their governments locally, whether at the city level, the state level, trying to change something, right? Many attorneys, this is a really specific area where attorneys work because you know, you've got this great legal education and background now. You understand what the legal framework, both internationally and domestically, is in your particular country or your context. And maybe let's say you think that there are some gaps in your legal framework in your country or in the country where your organization is working, and you want to be able to either close that gap or create a new law to address some sort of issue or problem that needs to be addressed. So I would say, especially for the Americans in the room, I personally, and this is, again, based on some of the WCL classes that I attended here, working internationally, coming from a Western perspective, a developed perspective, there are going to be challenges when you are working internationally because there will be some pushback from local communities when you say, as an American, I think you should be doing X, Y, and Z. So the approach that I have found really effective and that I've done when working overseas is finding local partners. And as an attorney, I was able to say, okay, I can give you the tools, I can give you the resources, but you at the local level need to be able to identify what are the needs and areas for improvement in your own context. And allowing those communities to come up with those topics or those gaps themselves, and then supporting that from your legal perspective is a very, very important thing to be able to do. So I have up here on the screen, and apologies, again, next time we do this, we're going to have tables and internet access, because some of these resources are just so long that it's best to have them in front of you physically, and this is a, 40-page document, so I wasn't going to print it out for all of you.
Can you guys hear this? Okay, it's working. All right. So this is a sample toolkit that we put together at my old organization. Are you guys familiar with hearing this? It seems rather low. Is that on? Okay. Hopefully it works. I'm sure we'll hear about it later if it's not. So this gives quite a few... I'm sorry, you probably are not going to be able to see this from far away. But this basically goes through the overview of all of the different steps of an advocacy campaign. And this is written for those who are on the ground and implementing, not for an American or a Western attorney implementing. This is more for the people who are putting together a campaign. You know, if you're in Jordan and you want to implement a labor law, this is how you would do a better job of trying to get the Minister of Social Affairs and the Minister of Labor to implement that law. Excuse me, I'm just going to close the door.
I just have one question. So, these just about the manual.
the same manual that you work on, or what's the source of the manual?
This is a manual that was put together that I worked on, and it was worked on by quite a few people at Vital Voices. So the link is on the last page of your packet. There's additional resources, and it's online resources.
Great.
So the link is in here. And we're going to put this online as well, so that you can click right to it. Mm-hmm. If you also just Google Vital Voices Advocacy Toolkit, this will come up.
Why did you pick that particular one as opposed to any other?
Can you ask the question into the microphone?
That's pretty much.
I have this one. So.
Why did you pick this particular toolkit or manual as opposed to any other organizations?
Because I've implemented this one. It's the one I know. So there are, again, I had a couple of people comment, yes, this is a very human rights focused training, mostly because I have worked on human rights and humanitarian law programs. Not to say that these tools do not apply to many, many, many other sectors. Don't get bogged down by the content. It's the technical tools. I mean, you can apply this to any context, whether you're building wells, improving education, doing economic development, giving humanitarian assistance. The context does not matter. These are the tools. No matter what kind of a context you're going to use, that you're going to be able to apply this in order to do. For advocacy, again, this is, and this was also written for Middle East and North Africa perspective. This particular toolkit was written with a Middle East, North Africa perspective in mind, mostly because advocacy is very rarely done there. The concept of advocacy, practically non-existent. People don't even understand the term. So we first had to have conversations about, and again, in some countries, it's not even legal to have an NGO or a nonprofit organization. So having conversations first about what the role of an NGO is, what is advocacy, going and trying to make a change in a political context or a policy or a procedural or some sort of change, shifting something. So that's sometimes a hurdle for many people because if they've never done it before, they don't understand why it's even necessary. You need to have that conversation ahead of time. So the toolkit starts out with what an advocacy campaign is, what is advocacy to begin with, defining and organizing. When I implemented this program, again, this was a State Department implemented program, we gathered, I think it was like 40 participants together from seven different countries, and we tried to have representations from all three sectors, the public sector, the private sector, and the NGO community. So government, NGOs, and private sector. Brought together between five and seven women from each country representing all three sectors, and asked them to get together and talk about what do you think are the most important issues or legal gaps for women in your community. Again, this is a very narrow topic, so don't get confused by the topic. But the point is, we asked them to identify what the gap was. And once they, then they came up with a list, and then we asked them to prioritize it. What do you think is most important? What do you think you can change fairly effectively? What do you think you have the contacts and skills to be able to shift? And there's quite a few tools in this toolkit, handouts, forms that just help you think through all of those different steps. So the first is coming up with the issue. We first, again, for those of you who are lawyers, this is going to sound really familiar with the IRAC system. So coming up with a problem, the solution, and the advocacy objective. So for example, in Jordan, they decided there's this wonderful labor law that had been passed, and it required large corporations with, I think it was like 20 or more female employees, with, I think there needed to be 10 children, something like that, that they established daycare facilities for women employees so that they could bring their children to work or have someplace for women to bring their children in order for them to keep their jobs. Great law, right? There was one company in Jordan that abided by that. There's lots of large corporations in Jordan. Only one company had a daycare facility. So they thought, well, if we want to improve, because they knew the data, they knew that the number of women that left the workforce after having children was really, really low. And many of them had worked in the economic development community before, so they knew. There's been research, there's data out there, there's been, you know, assessments that have been done ahead of time. So we know that the rate of women not going back to work after having a child is really, really low. We also know that if, you know, I think the World Bank maybe had done a survey. So we also know if women actually had returned to the workforce, the GDP of the country would increase dramatically, because now you have all of those women contributing towards the economic welfare of the country. And at that point, Jordan was struggling, and you know, they were trying to think of ways to improve the economic welfare of the country as a whole. So, you know, if you've got 30% of your available workforce that is leaving in droves, and one of the major reasons why they say that they're not returning is because they don't have access to childcare, and there is a law out there that requires large companies to actually have this resource available, they thought this is a really simple way to increase something very tangible. So again, please don't get caught up with the contact or the context here, because this is just an example. But this type of issue identification problem and thinking about how to come up with a solution is a way that you can think about, you know, how you would go about implementing this. So they came up with the advocacy objective. Then they identified their audience. Who is it that is going to be a major player in this field? How do you get the right people on board? Who is the decision maker? You know, it's great if you've got you know, all the local NGOs on board, fantastic. But it's not up to the NGOs, right? It's up to the CEOs of these big communities or these big companies. Maybe the Ministry of Labor and Social Development might have something to say about it. Maybe there are institutional or legal barriers so that companies can't actually open daycare centers. You know, maybe there are so many restrictions on, you know, child care provision, et cetera, they physically can't, even if they wanted to, open a daycare center. So they went and identified all the different key players that were necessary in order to make this shift. Then they worked on identifying, well, okay, we've got government folks, we've got private sector folks, the NGO community partners that we've identified can help lobby or advocate for these things. Let's bring them all together, because it's not just up to one sector. If you've got one sector doing something on their own, it's going to be a very narrow approach. If you've got all sectors working on something together, it's going to be a much, much stronger approach. So building a coalition, super important. Endorsement letters. Once they got the Secretary General working for the Ministry of Labor on board, he was their number one advocate. Again, he was their number one advocate. He would write letters. He appeared in the news. They did this big march through Amman. He was out in front holding the banner. I mean, the media went nuts, because you've got a guy who is standing up for women's rights in Amman. I mean, it was incredible. So having some high-level key stakeholders willing to publicly endorse a campaign, if you can get that, again, fantastic. And again, for those of us who are from an American or Western perspective, this is a great way to ask these questions. You're not going to be the one going and asking the Ministry of Labor to write this. It's going to be the people on the ground. But you can say, who is it that you should that can make this decision? Who is it whose buy-in is super important to getting this done? And asking those key questions, because you're not going to be able to answer them. It's going to be the people on the ground implementing this that are going to be able to answer those questions and physically go and ask those questions. Then a communication plan. We're going to talk about social media in a minute. But not only is social media important, but traditional communication is really important. You know, how many of you know how to write a press release? Not something they typically teach in law school, right? how do you contact the news? How many people of you would know, who do you contact at the Washington Post if you want them to write a story about something? Maybe not. So the toolkit goes through kind of the steps for a communication plan. Who do you want to target? How do you want to target them? what are some of the key tools, you know, a press release, a sample draft of an article. We're going to go through a little bit more detail of the social media plan in a second. There's lots of different ways to get communication out there, through traditional media sources, through social media sources, through the community in general. In Lebanon, the group that was working on a different campaign for a different issue, they created a coalition of, I want to say, over 100 different NGOs. Those NGOs were spread all over the country and had networks of, I think, close to, well, tens of thousands of people that they worked with in their communities. They created documents all together, and then those local organizations, like literally in little tiny towns, in refugee camps, in the north, south, all over the place, in Beirut, and they went out and they were able to talk about this campaign to thousands and thousands and thousands of women, even if they had no articles in newspapers, no media presence, but because they had a really great coalition of organizations that worked with local communities, they were able to reach, have a huge, huge reach. And then some of the organizational development pieces, and we talked a little bit about this yesterday, when you're, especially for communities that have never done something like this before, never implemented a program, have never managed a grant, it can be a bit daunting. So coming up with some of these tools that we talked about yesterday, a log frame, a budget, a task list, who's going to do what? You know, say you've got this great committee or of volunteers that's willing to do this kind of a project, but in case unless nobody has really clearly defined roles and responsibilities, people are going to be stepping on each other's toes, there's going to be confusion over who's responsible for doing what. So coming up with a lot of these resources ahead of time saves you a lot of heartache and turmoil on the back end. Volunteers, also very, very important. When you're working on a campaign of this size, it's great to have a couple people sort of taking charge in the lead, but you're going to need, you know, if you've got 100 NGOs that are all coordinating together, and then each of those NGOs are going out into their communities, you're going to need a lot of people doing the footwork. If you're doing surveys of women in Egypt in really rural communities, you're going to need people who are actually going to go out into those communities, right, and do that data gathering. So you're going to need a lot of manpower and support, woman power too. All right. Again, fundraising, monitoring, evaluation, all of that is in here. But this is, again, specifically around an advocacy kind of campaign as opposed to training people on how to go out and dig wells. So this is just another set of tools and resources that you can take a look at depending on the kind of work that you're doing. Again, please don't get confused with the content here, because this can be, these tools can be applied to many, many different kinds of projects, whether you're doing political advocacy, economic work, etc. And then public-private dialogue. As I mentioned, having a multi-sectoral approach is a really, really great way to be the most effective. A top-down government approach, great, but if you don't have a way to get the corporations to implement the law or institutionalize it, you can go after them sort of, you know, it's a carrot and stick approach. You can go after them and threaten to fine them, or even the bottom, a solely bottom-up approach. It can be effective. If you've got 100 NGOs working on something, and they've got all of their local communities really, really excited about something, great. But unless you get the buy-in from Parliament to institutionalize whatever it is you're asking for, it's not going to work. You need both. And when you get the private sector support, particularly if you can get them to give you money, it's even better. Because a lot of times they have there's some buy-in on their part. Either it affects their bottom line, it makes them look good in the press. They've got some reason for probably wanting to support. Figure out what it is that they are looking for, what their interest is. Capitalize on that, and then ask them to support in that way. Sometimes it's just providing meeting space. You know, if you want to have big committee meetings because you've got 100 super interested volunteers, but you are just forming an NGO and you don't have office space yet, you might be able to borrow some conference rooms. And large corporations have that kind of space available. They might be able to donate it to your group to be able to meet. So again, there's lots of different ways that you can get buy-in from each of the different sectors. And yeah, again, a lot of these are just there's a lot of examples, press releases, sample budgets, business plans, endorsement letters, research, advocacy tools. So take a look. We'll provide the link online for you to be able to open this up, or again, just Google Vital Voices Advocacy Toolkit. And again, this is not rocket science. This is not the only tool out there. This is just the one that I've used, and I find it very, very helpful. But there are many, many other tools out there. Lots of organizations do fantastic work and have similar tools out there. So don't just take this as the end all be all. Google things. I mean, you can come up with a whole. In fact, my sister recently, who, because technically I am not a millennial, I just missed the cutoff, but she is, and she says she gets most of her resources via Twitter. So apparently, Twitter is a great place, you know, to just start, type in search terms, and there are lots of tools and things on Twitter that you can find for great resources. So, and she's an international teacher in third world countries, basically teach kids how to read in Mauritania. So if she can find information on Twitter, I'm pretty sure that there are other fabulous resources out there that will be helpful to you as well. Okay. I think we'll let this, we won't go through the whole thing because it will take us forever. Let's see.
I think I'm going to take yours.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry about that.
So any questions so far on the advocacy toolkit? Okay.
Yeah. I don't have a question, but it's just I want to thank you for this workshop. It's very interesting. I have interned for ABA early, and when I got there, I had to face this thing. I said, wow. I thought it was just researches, and I couldn't do it because I didn't have risk skills. So my suggestion would be like, can we have like a hypothesis call where we can use the actual figures to do the charts, the Excel chart, everything, where we can put it in practice, because like explaining like that, it seems easy, but to practice is a different thing.
That's actually something that I'm talking with Melania about, because this workshop is just an overview. It's basically just to tell you what it is you need to know, because we don't have the time to go into each document and play with it. So that's something that we're talking about. And if you look on the bottom of the online resources and then trainings and workshops, I put a list of other courses available here that are... they actually are dedicated workshops that will train you on how to use each of these tools or even develop some of these tools. So for fundraising and program development, there's quite a few tools and resources for, and workshops at the Foundation Center that they offer for free. Even at SIS on main campus, they have some classes that will teach you how to put some of these together. When I was doing my LLM here, I took some of the classes up there because you can... I think you can get up to 6 credits that can transfer to part of your degree program here. And they have literally hands-on classes. How do you do strategic planning for a human rights NGO? I mean, some really specific ones that will give you some of these technical skills, monitoring, evaluation, developing some of these skill sets. So I would take a look to see if any of those classes would be something that you're interested in, because you can... you know, take that as part of your degree program here. And then for program and personnel management, monitoring and evaluation, a lot of these also include budget management as part of that. I put a list of organizations and courses here. These do cost some money, but if you are interested in getting some further training, definitely look into these. And then I think it's really important. You're not going to be able to get all of these at an internship like ABA, really. But if you want to develop them, you can say, look, I'm really, really interested in learning how to put a budget together, or managing a budget, or putting a program proposal together, and I want to be able to work on that and come out of that with this skill set once I leave this internship. most likely your internships are going to be very receptive to that and give you opportunities to develop those skills, which will then help you when you're job searching after you've graduated. But unfortunately, with these workshops, we just don't have the time to go into the nitty-gritty of each of these tools. But I wanted to at least make you aware of the fact that these tools and documents exist so that you can start playing. And we'll put some of these online so you can actually start working with them yourself and kind of playing around and seeing how they work, particularly the Excel ones.
What is the Foundation Center?
It's an organization called the Foundation Center. Yeah, so the, in the parentheses and under each one, these are all organizations, Foundation Center, Inside NGO, PMI, Vital Smarts. These are all organizations. All right, any other questions on the advocacy toolkit? Okay, great. So then, let's see. There's a page in your packet that says blogging on the top. Again, apologies, I didn't get these numbered. We just figured it'd be easier than shuffling through a bazillion pages. But this is the start of a list of tools and some advice when you're putting together a social media campaign. And again, it doesn't matter what the topic is. It could be anything from building wells to education to political advocacy. Whatever it is, and whatever tools you think are most useful for your work, these are some really great tips and guidelines to be able to use those. And these are not the only ones out there. God knows that Tumblr and I'm going to show my Luddite tendencies here, but I'm not going to name off all of the social media tools out there. Instagram, there's quite a few out there and different ways of using them. These are just some high-level pieces of advice to start thinking about how do you have a better outreach than maybe just a sample press release that you would send to the traditional media.
Yeah, that is my question, actually. So my question is, before you start to introduce the new social media, would you please just let us know how the NGO to approach the traditional media like Washington Post you mentioned before? Like
how invite them to. Actually, do you want to take another question or? I see here you've got Pinterest. What would you use Pinterest for as, you know, for advocacy? I mean, it's pictures. Are you putting pictures of your activities and?
Yep. Okay, let's say you're doing a measles campaign. You're vaccinating kids with measles, or you're teaching them how to have better hand sanitation so that you're not spreading, God forbid, Ebola. You know, if you're doing some sort of... Okay, I think that everybody knows, if you put any pictures up online anywhere that feature children or puppies, you're going to get a lot more traction. People love pictures of children and puppies. So the cuter or more heartwarming or more picturesque, you know, a picture says more, you know, what is it, a picture is worth a thousand words. You can write the most brilliant press release known to man and send it to the Washington Post and the New York Times, and you can even get Nicholas Kristof to write an article about it. You put a picture of cute kids and puppies washing hands or, you know, rescuing them from a brothel or whatever it is, you're going to get a lot more interest, you know, because it's easily shareable on Facebook, or, you know, you can get a bazillion likes on Instagram, you know, it goes viral on Tumblr, whatever it is. Visual depictions of whatever you're doing are a great way to capture that information. Infograms, you know, having, you know, quick facts and blurbs about the numbers of people that you've taught 37,000 girls how to read. You've increased the literacy rate by 67%. You know, whatever it is, showing that kind of visual depiction of the successes or the activities of your program, very, very great. They're great ways to get people to either share that information, like that information, get knowledge about that information. You know, there's so many people, billions of people now on Facebook, Twitter. you know, if you're trying to explain a concept more in depth, having a blog that you update regularly. There are, and again, there are people out there who do social media as a job and could explain this in far more depth than I can. There's a lot of great tips in here, but there are, the social media person on my team, she knows what time of day, what day of the week, how to best put out information. Like, she will never ever send an invitation to come to an event on a Monday or a Friday. She will only send it at like Tuesday at 10 a.m. because that's the best possible time to get people to come to an event, or you know, whatever it is. So there are some tips like that listed here. For your question about traditional media, the advocacy toolkit has a lot of examples of sample press releases, how to approach an editor, how to, I'm not sure that there's information in there about how to write an op-ed, but you can easily Googleable, you know, look online for, you know, how would you write an op-ed. I think I've read, don't quote me on this, but I think it's something like 500 words. You know, if it's more than 500 words, you're never going to get published. You need to write something really succinct and easily digestible, because if you write 2,000 words, they don't have space to print it. But if you want something that's very high level and quick and easy for someone to print, you know, keep it short. Again, you guys are all in law school, so you're really, really good at explaining something in very few words. If you've taken legal writing one, you should hopefully have that skill. So the social media tips here go through some best practices on blogging, Twitter, how to use the right tone, you know, retweet, send direct messages, using only 1 to 2 hashtags, but don't use a lot. Don't shout at people using all caps. Use pictures. Again, children and puppies, very popular. If you can use hot topics or things that are currently in the news, it makes it more relevant and makes people maybe pay attention a little bit more. Inspiration and humor, also great things to incorporate. See here? Scheduling tweets. Tons of people are checking in around lunchtime, with peak posting days falling between Monday and Thursday. Don't ever, ever send anything out on a Friday, because no one will read it. They've already checked out, and they're on the weekends already. There's, 3 o'clock on a Friday. Nobody will pay attention, so don't ever do it. again, how to set up a Facebook page. And there's, in the advocacy toolkit, there is more information there about how to set up an advocacy campaign. Depending on what it is that your project's about, look at the field. There are tons of advocacy pages out there from all of your favorite organizations, all your favorite campaigns. You know, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, all of those big organizations, they are masters of this. So check them out, see what they're doing, see what you like, see how they operate, see what kinds of, see the kinds of language that they use. You know, they will always make a really specific ask. They want you to do something. They want to make it really simple for you. They want you to donate money, retweet, send a letter to your congressman, and they've already got the template already filled out, so all you have to do is literally type in your email address, and it sends a pre-generated letter to your congressman and your senators asking them to sign on to whatever it is that you're interested in. Make it stupid simple, because the easier it is, people are more likely to do it. Now, you can... There is a kind of a fine line there, because if you don't want people to kind of burn out or to not pay attention, you know, your audience. Think about who your audience is. You don't want people to just say, oh, people are just retweeting this because it's popular. You know, bring back our girls. 5 bazillion people retweeted that. You want to make sure that that message is still potent, that people actually really do care, and that there's something tangible that they can do rather than just armchair advocacy. You know, giving them something tangible to do physically other than just retweeting. Retweeting is great, and sometimes it can make a big difference, and the Bring Back Our Girls campaign is a really great example of that. But you want to make sure that there's actually something maybe physical that they can do as well. Can they donate money? Can they contribute to a campaign? Can they... help you buy blankets or contribute to the building of a well or whatever it is, buy books for a school that maybe got bombed and they don't have any textbooks anymore. whatever it is, give them something tangible to do other than just retweet. Retweeting's great. Make sure that they have something else to do as well. Again, Facebook, great tool to use. Keep it short and simple, because if people are reading three paragraphs, they're going to get bored, and it's not something that they can just scroll through on their news feed. There are best times to do it, 1 to 4 p.m., best times to put stuff on Facebook, because people are in need of a mid-afternoon coffee, and they, you know, take the time to check their Facebook in the afternoon. Excuse me. Erica's on his back. Hey there. Okay. You could, it's a French, or Tennytown, not Van Ness. Tennytown. Van Ness is
one
stop away. Yep. Okay, so get out of the metro and then go across the head towards the AU bus, across the street, and there's another bus that goes in the direction of the Whole Foods. Okay. Thanks. Sorry, got a little lost.
But if he is in Badness, it's easier to take a taxi than go inside again.
Well, it's okay. He'll make it.
I have one question.
Yep.
In regards to, thank you.
Thank you. In regards to the advocacy and communication, how does your Department of Advocacy and Communication is the structure? I mean, I'm not asking for confidential details, but like, how will you structure a advocacy and communication department, meaning you have what is the approach to Congress, for example, local government or private sector. But on the other hand, you also have the development of media. So, So just that question.
I think it depends for every organization what their capacity is. If you have quite a bit of money coming in, you've got the ability to hire three people, one to focus maybe on social media, one to do traditional press releases and outreach to traditional media, and one person to create sort of the content and documents, right? It really depends. Organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, some of the really big ones, they've got a machine to handle these kinds of communications. Smaller NGOs, they might have one person in charge of all communication. So it really, really depends on what the size of your organization is, how much advocacy you're willing to do. If you've got one full-time staff person available to go and spend every single day on the Hill, fantastic. Most organizations do not. Amnesty International probably has 10. You know, I have no idea. I'm totally guessing. It really just depends on what your organizational capacity is. Maybe you think that advocacy is a primary goal, and so you're going to put that in your objectives, that one of your primary prongs is to do advocacy work, communications. And so when you're, you know, that's going to trickle down into your budget too. So you might say, okay, we've got a VP or a director, and then we need three people to do advocacy and communications implementation. So you're going to budget for that. All of your work, you might not be having conferences all the time or doing trainings. It might just be you're paying staff time to go out and do outreach. So it really depends on how you structure your grant, your proposal, your work, and what the outcomes that you're looking for are. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so there's no right answer.
Yes.
It just depends on what capacity you have, what kind of income you've got coming in, to be able to handle the kind of outreach and communications that you want.
I guess that...
Let
me rephrase.
Yeah, that totally makes sense what you said. Depends on the capacity of the organization. Let me rephrase the question. Like, how will a very good advocacy and communication department could probably be structured? meaning if the organization has a requirement, who would you hire for? For example, we have a director of advocacy. Mm-hmm. That's the only person that we have in our organization. So if it's a bigger organization, who else would you hire mm-hmm. in order to make a more strong advocacy and communication department?
I guess media.
Yeah. If it were me, I probably have one person setting the strategy, like a director of advocacy, one person doing social media, and one person doing content and traditional media outreach. Because you're going to get a lot of information for your advocacy and communications plans from your programs team. So you're going to get the nuts and bolts of there were this many schools created in this area, or you know, there's this many wells dug in this area, or whatever it is, all the day-to-day stuff. Your program team is going to have a lot of that, but it needs to be sort of shaped and made pretty and understandable, digestible. If you can put it into 40 characters or less and put it on Facebook, that takes a bit of skill, but you want to make sure that it's technically correct too. So it's a partnership between your programs team and your communications team, but having someone dedicated to that on staff is really, really helpful. If you can have somebody, or if it's the goal of your organization to have somebody on the Hill quite a bit, great to have somebody dedicated to that. Because there is a special skill set that comes with lobbying on the Hill, talking with congressmen and women, giving them the kinds of information that they're looking for, maybe bringing visitors to the Hill when they come into town to talk about the work that you're doing. It's a special skill set. You know, it's a special audience. As opposed to somebody that's doing social media communications that is basically just blasting out on Twitter all the time and all they do is just respond to tweets all day. You know, Amnesty International, I'm sure that they have somebody dedicated to tweeting and retweeting and responding to tweets personally all day long. I have no doubt. Again, I have not asked them this, but because of the volume of tweet, I literally had to unfollow Amnesty because it was just solid Amnesty tweets because they're so robust in their communications online. So I go and check them every once in a while, but if I were to follow them, it would just be a solid Amnesty, you know, on my Twitter feed. So again, depends on your capacity, depends on your goals, but it is great to have somebody in each of those roles if at all possible. Any other questions on the social media or advocacy toolkits? Okay. Then next, let's talk a little bit about success stories and lessons learned. I'm going to put it up again. The last page of your packet, there's some links on there that we'll provide online, and I'm going to pull up some samples online right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry about that. So I've pulled up a couple of examples of success stories and lessons learned. Remember how I said that donors are not going to get really angry at you if you don't have tremendous success in your programs? It is okay for there to be some stories saying this did not work, but hopefully you will have some stories to share with your donor to say this was an amazing success and you want to brag about it, to show them that you have spent their money in the most effective and fantastic way possible and you've had great success. So these examples, and again the links are on the resource page for you, of explaining the process. This was a campaign that was done years and years ago by a group in Jordan that I did not work with, but we looked at their work to see how they structured an advocacy campaign and what were the results. And they went through and explained what they did, you know, again, the issue here, why it was that they decided on this campaign in the first place, what the framework was, what were the institutional issues or political issues that they were facing, and what the law currently was, why it needed to be revised, you know, what were the problems with it, and then what they did. So they formed this coalition, they did several advocacy steps. Again, you can look through this in greater detail. They basically did a big campaign. They worked with lots of partners, they contacted people in the government to try to get buy-in, and then there was a law that was created. Actually the law was revised because it wasn't a great law to begin with, and they were trying to ask for lots of things to be changed. So they got some things that they wanted, and so they go through and they explain what was it they got that was good, and sorry about that. Yeah, so they got some good changes, and then some things that they thought they really wished that they could have had, areas where there still needs to be improvement, partners that they think should be involved, some of the mechanisms that need to be changed in order to have really good implementation. And so this was the result. This is where they were. I think this was in 2009 or 2010 when they wrote this report. This is where things stood when they wrote this report. Where, you know, what was successful, what was not successful, what still needs to be done in the future, and why there's still a need there. And then they also explained, remember how I said it's okay to say where you either face challenges or things didn't go well? Be upfront with your donor. Say why things didn't work, say what you tried and what maybe failed or didn't work the way you thought it would. Be open about that, because again, if somebody's going to try to do this later or improve the areas where you thought needed to be done the next time around, you don't want them reinventing the wheel. So showing what you tried maybe didn't work is a really great learning opportunity. So they call these mistakes. You can call them mistakes, you can call them challenges, whatever you feel most comfortable using, and lessons learned. And you know, this is how they're going to try to improve in the future, areas of opportunity, ways that they can collaborate or work better together, and recommendations. So how to change the law, how to do a better job, how to target key players more effectively in the future. The Ministry of Social Development was maybe a big player that they didn't involve right away, and they should have. So this goes through, it's a very, very small example, but it gives some really clear recommendations on, you know, what they did, what was the history, what was the problem, what was their attempt at a solution, what worked, what didn't work, and how do they move on, what's next for them, assuming that they get more money or a different grantor to help them improve in the future. And then this is a case study. So the campaign that I've been talking about that did advocacy work in the Middle East and North Africa, remember how I mentioned that there were some countries where things did not go well. So in Oman, for example, didn't work. We tried, it did not work. So the countries where we had some really fantastic successes, we documented exactly what we did, what the steps were that they took, what the progress that they made was. So if you want to look at the campaigns, and so a little bit more detail, in Morocco they were trying to change the law and end early marriage for girls, particularly in the rural communities and with the Berber populations. In Egypt, they were trying to incorporate some gender provisions in the new constitution. This was back in 2011 when they were drafting the new constitution, and they were trying to improve lives of women and some of the legal protections that existed or didn't exist. In Jordan, they were trying to implement that labor law to have access to childcare for women who were working in big corporations. And in Lebanon, they were trying to change some gender discriminatory laws in the areas of inheritance, taxation, social security. There was one other one, but it basically revolved around economic access for women who they were trying to get better tax rates, social security benefits, etc. So there were some really great successes there, and please feel free to take a look. I think there were some really great ideas that they had, some really creative approaches. Great ways of forming coalitions. You know, again, if you're, no matter what sector you're in, some of these ideas can be very helpful. And then in Oman, we worked with a group of women who were trying to, I'm blanking a little bit now. They were working on banking sector reform. Well, there's no such thing really as an NGO in Oman, or there wasn't at this time. There was no institutional buy-in from the heads of the banks in Oman, so getting women having women access positions of leadership or power within the banking industry, it wasn't happening. They just were not interested. Advocacy is pretty much non-existent in Oman, particularly during the Arab Spring. It wasn't going to happen. We tried and we tried and we tried and we tried, and eventually we decided, okay, we're going to go to Tunisia and Algeria. At the time that we wrote this, those campaigns hadn't ended, so this is only capturing some of the campaigns that had ended by the time of publishing. And they, I think some of them were later added to this, but the overall toolkit you can, again, check out, and it might give you some good examples. But it's what I think the most important thing is sharing the success stories, because you're doing really great work, right? You've written this great proposal, you've gotten the money, you're implementing, you've got this brilliant log frame, and you've implemented, you've changed things, you've got this massive percentage of improvement in whatever field it is. Now you got to share that story, because you want to win another grant, right? You want to be able to continue doing the amazing work that you're doing. But unless you capture those stories and share pictures, again, put puppies and kids in there, make it look pretty. We had a really fantastic local vendor here, actually, that we worked with to lay this out in a really pretty format. It wasn't very expensive, but it had lots of pretty colors, and make it look attractive so that people go, wow, not only did you do a great job, but you've explained to me in very simple words how you did your campaign or your job or your program, whatever it was, and this is how you were successful. And I can also see that you've learned some lessons from what didn't work, and you've explained to me how you're going to change in the future to make it more successful. Again, donors are not unwilling to hear what didn't work as long as you can explain what you learned from it. Any questions on this?
At what stage do you apply for the next round of funding?
Oh, I hate giving this answer because it's always the same. It depends. I would usually say at least a year out, because it sometimes, especially for U.S. government grants, it takes a while, for unsolicited or solicited proposals. It takes a while to get through the process, to win the grant, to negotiate the grant, to implement the grant. It's going to take a bit, so I would say start looking 18 months out, start applying at least a year out, and then you can also negotiate the start time. You know, if you're wrapping up a program and you're writing up a final report, you just don't have the time to also start a new one, you don't have the staff capacity, you can say, look, we're finishing this grant period for this other grant, either with you or with another donor in June, why don't we start July 1st on this new program? And you have that ability to negotiate that. But I wouldn't leave it until you know, you're writing up your final report and then going, oh crap, I want to keep my staff employed, so I better start looking for more money. Look in advance.
But if you if you do need to refer, as you're saying, the final report, you're referring back to, okay, this is what worked and what didn't. If you haven't done this report yet, how do you tell them the lessons you've learned and how you're planning on changing it when you haven't even assessed yet what the final result was?
This is actually something you would do. This was a final part of our final report. So when we were putting this together, we included this as part of our final report to say, okay, we've been working on this program for 2 years. This is what we've learned. And trust me, while we were doing the last probably 6 to 9 months of this program, we were starting to apply for more money. Because we didn't have all of the data, but we had a lot of it. And we were able to say, this is what we've learned so far. This is where we think things are going in some of these programs or countries. Here's the lessons we've learned and how we would do things differently if we were to do it all over again. Because a lot of these things we created from scratch. And so next time around, like, we created the advocacy toolkit for the first 6 months of the program. Next time around, we don't have to create an advocacy toolkit. We might tweak it or update it or, you know, change a few things here and there, but that might take a month instead of 6 months to write the whole thing from the beginning. So it's going to be a lot easier to say when you're applying 6 months before the end of a program, you're going to have a lot of data to be able to say, this is what has worked. And again, a lot of donors do year-long grants, and that's really hard because it's hard to initiate, start up, implement, and final report in 1 year. I hate that. You know, it's so much better when you have 2 to 3 years and a multi-year grant to be able to accurately implement a program. So you will be able to capture a lot of that data. It's harder on a 1 year grant.
So if it is a 1 year, at what stage do you start? 6 months?
6 months, yeah. Okay. Hopefully, I mean, if you are implementing a 1 year grant, it sure as heck better not be complicated because you don't have the time. Because you need sometimes 6 months to really start up a program. So hopefully it's something really simple. Maybe it's something that you're already doing and you're just adding some technical pieces or some advocacy pieces. Like, you're not starting a whole new program from start to finish. You're just either adding on some services or tools to an existing program, or it's a really, really simple thing. You don't need a lot of staff time and resources to create new tools and resources to be able to implement it, because it is really hard to do that in 1 year. It's incredibly difficult. Any other questions?
So do you all of the program you have completed, I mean follow up, after you have completed the program, then for example, it's like a 2 year program. Like, will you go back and see what's happening after this after the 2 years?
In an ideal world, yes. Assuming that your organization has money to do it. And actually, something that I wanted to mention, when you're doing the evaluations, you can do a pre and a post evaluation. But if you're doing a multi-year program, if it's 2 to 3 years, probably also going to want to do a mid-year evaluation or a mid-term evaluation, because God forbid you've done this great baseline assessment, you're doing all this work for 2 to 3 years to implement a program, and at the end of 3 years you do a final evaluation and you're going, oh my God, we've done a horrible job. We have, you know, a 5% improvement in literacy rates and we've spent $3 million on this. That's not good. Again, donors aren't unwilling to hear it, but hopefully you will have done, you know, a year and a half or 2 years into the program, do another assessment. How are we doing? Can we make any changes? Are there ways that we could be doing it better? So you have a little bit of time to course correct in case you need to make some changes to the program along the way. Maybe you're not getting the right stakeholders involved. Maybe you need to be doing more social media advocacy. Maybe you need to be using different suppliers to build something if you're supposed to be building new wells or schools or whatever it is. Maybe there's a lot of political turmoil and you're not able to implement the way you thought you would and you need to change countries. Whatever it is, keep an eye on that. Do a if at all possible, do a midterm evaluation to see if your outcomes and your outputs, if you're on track with how things are going, because that's a great way to help you make some changes if you need to along the way, and then you don't have to tell your donor at the very end. Really didn't do that well, because again, they're not unwilling to hear it, but they want to hear how you've been able to adjust along the way. Any other questions? Okay. Let me check the agenda here. Okay. Why don't we take a break? Eric is on his way in and should be here shortly. And we'll come back in about 15 minutes. Hopefully he'll be here by then. We'll start on the next section on public interest, government practice, and talking about careers. I just wanted to actually email you the document, and I didn't have
to. No, absolutely not. Yeah. So, what I'll do by the end of the day, I'll just let you know. Fine, you can send me the link so I can listen. Just to make sure he had it in. Yes.
Okay.
And then I'm going to ask him how to. Maybe he's going to create a page or something just so you can upload the document, because I want it to be only accessible.
Again, if you have questions, we'll take questions before the next.
All the materials are not going to be accessible, which is
not all of it, right, because of IP issues, intellectual property issues. She's using some of the information that's related to the project she was working on, so it's necessarily not okay to be public. But most of the, I think Christy said some of the documents of yesterday will be available. Okay. I think probably everything that we had today will be available.
Okay.
Again, the workshops will be easy to listen to, but will be password protected, like everything else on our web page.
Yes, but I would like
to... And the same thing, this will be also password protected, so you'll be able to access.
I was thinking about like creating a PDF package just to have it for my...
Sure.
Wasn't sure what documents to PDF. So when do you think I can like check on it?
Christy will probably by Friday let me know which documents, and then she's going to send it to me.
Okay.
These documents could be there. Because they actually already edited yesterday's presentation. They just sent me the link. But I'm not going to respond, because I want them to somehow add the documents to the link. I don't know how that's going to work out, but they'll figure it out. Probably it's possible.
Yeah.
It's going to be more difficult, but it's possible.
I may be able.
I'm always, when it comes to certain things technology related, I always believe it's possible.
Yeah.
I just like more work for them.
Yeah. Probably just can't answer it. Should not take. Well, it takes a little bit of a while.
No, but I mean, because they really have great people in IT office, so that's not a question.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and they were so nice. They were these, I think 2 hours ago or hour and a half ago, he sent me an email saying, I have it ready yesterday.
Oh, awesome. So then I'm going to wait.
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe they can combine two or having it on the same page. So you have, when you access the information, it's like workshop one, day one, workshop day two,
exactly.
And related documents. Probably that's what they.
Yeah, okay.
Probably the link will need to land you on a page.
Okay.
Instead of directly to the like podcast.
Okay.
I didn't say that to them all. I mean, yes. The only thing they kind of failed us on is that having that mic.
Yeah.
But I mean, Matthew explained yesterday that the problem with the mic, the vinyl is actually on you, on the speaker. The problem we have throughout the school, because the whole school is wireless, is that very often we have interference. Any given room, they accept. I think, but even though we actually never use that mic in room 600, the one that can have whatever 300 people, because usually people will just use the mics on the table. That's why I gave a hard time to Chris the social But you're really good with the mic and figuring out. Sometimes I feel like I'm taking a regular opportunity to understand.
Okay, thank you.
Hi. I was able to find.
Okay. This is Melania.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure.
Have a seat.
We don't have that portable mic just because it seems that we have usually problem with interference.
This room is very small, I'll be fine.
So we'll have this one, and Christy actually used that when she was just sitting next to us.
Gotcha.
And no worries about our conversation, we'll edit it later. So we have tons of people who wanted to listen to it later. No, it's not live.
They'll edit.
Presentations are something that everyone is interested in, but then it's also hard to create a schedule that will work with everyone's schedule, right. Students and alumni, because actually huge alumni populations would like to check in, but it was impossible to make it live. So. Okay. But plus we can actually have some documents there as well and share that too.
Okay, great.
Thank you for coming.
My pleasure. Okay.
And we'll have bios also posted together with the workshops.
Okay.
Yes, I yes. You'll give me a minute or so.
Please.
Because I actually do want to reread the bio as well, because I don't know how easy it's going to be to click on it or not, but because I introduced Christy yesterday, so.
Okay. So how are you? Ready for our big 2-day training?
It's like a week delay, right?
2 weeks.
About,
no,
yeah,
right.
Like 2 days.
No, it's like 3 weeks because it's.
No, it's November 12, other than 12.
It's like 2 weeks.
Two and a half.
I've got some time to like prepare.
You do. It's like a Tuesday,
like,
Tuesday to Wednesday.
Get ready for that.
You'll be fine. You'll be great. I can already tell you'll be great.
Thanks.
I've been bragging.
Oh, have you?
Obviously.
Something about walking on water, I don't know. Back on, got off the telephone, and I was looking for the struggles with the regular buses are, and then I was like, this is a clear, and I turned around and I saw a whole bunch of shuttle buses on the bus, that's probably it. So I walked over there and I said, just the shuttle bus, yep. So I walked on and closed the doors. Got lucky. Some of your luck.
Yeah.
No, I do not.
For the next part of our presentation today, dedicated to public interest and government practice, we have our next guest speaker join us, Mr. Eric Guthrie, who is the president and CEO of Better Me, Better We. Eric studied at Morehouse College biology as part of the pre-medicine program, and there he became involved with community affairs and politics. As the president of the Georgia College Democrats, he worked on various political campaigns, including the 1988 presidential campaign. Eric dedicated his time to medical school, but decided to pursue a bigger career. He graduated in 1992 from Columbia Law School, and during the legal studies, he continued his community involvement. Post-graduation, he has served as a district attorney for Kings County in New York. Later, Eric relocated to Hartford, Connecticut, and worked as an employment and labor attorney for the state of Connecticut. Since then, Eric has moved up the corporate and government ladder, occupying executive positions in two Fortune 500 companies. During this time, Eric realized he had passion for public speaking and creating and developing trainings. He has trained thousands of supervisors, employees, and managers on diversity, legal issues, ethics, and management skills. He has served as a motivational speaker and conducted trainings in most of the United States, also Canada, Thailand, and Japan. He was also a visiting professor and is an adjunct professor with the United States Department of State Foreign Service Institute. Eric started Better Me, Better We in 2008, where the company's sponsors and writers share Eric's passion for education and of the community, and communicate the positive and powerful message of diversity to companies, nonprofits, organizations, and educational institutions. Eric's larger clients include United States Department of State, the American Red Cross, Unique Caring, and INET Communications. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. So, thank you. I appreciate it. So, you've heard some about me, and I want to hear a little bit about you guys. Are you guys 2Ls, 3Ls, or are you? Or are you graduates?
LMs.
Nice. Okay. Great. I'm going to try something a little different. I don't know what they've been doing in the past couple of days, but I'm going to flip the room. And that means that I'm not going to actually flip the room physically, but I'm going to let you ask me the questions you want to have me answer if I can. And that way I'm not just sitting here talking about myself. I want to be able to respond to your questions and give you the kind of answers that you may be looking for from someone like myself. So is there anything that you guys want to ask me in terms of your career, going to public interest, going to corporations, going to law firms, back and forth, that I can help you with? Yes.
Hi. My name is Alan.
I'm an LLM.
I am an LLM student.
Well, I graduated already.
I graduated from the LLM program here at American University, and I'm currently working for a nonprofit organization which develops water and sanitation projects in Africa and Latin America.
Right.
So I am still in an entry position within the organization, and I like development, but I want to stay in this field. Somehow I'm also very interested in the private sector, specifically in project finance. How do you think a transition from what I'm doing right now, which is public interest and development, could be in terms of switching to a completely private sector field as private finances. Why would an advice, what advice could you give probably, or a recommendation based on your experience?
Okay.
So one of the things when I looked back, when I looked at my career, I found that most of the jobs I had, after I had them, I didn't even apply for them. They were just put in front of me. For example, there were two or three jobs that I got that I was sitting on a board, and then someone approached me after I, you know, worked on the board for a year or two, and they said, why don't you come work for us? But I wasn't working for them at that point in time. I was on the board. And I remember one time, this was like in the peak of the 90s when jobs were just flying off trees, you can get a job anywhere. And some guy said, well, you know, you should come work for us. And I was like, okay, well, he said, send me your resume. I said, all right. Now, I didn't think he was being serious. I think it was just, you know, recruiters kind of just talk a lot of junk sometimes. So I sent my resume as I promised I would. 2 days later, he goes, we got a job for you. And I was like, wow, that was pretty fast. So the two pieces of advice I would give you is, the first is to join an organization that's in line with what you want to do. I don't know what that is because I'm not very involved in the water and sanitation business. It probably may be something with engineering or facility management, something like that. And the second is, if you have an opportunity to join a board, get on a board. Boards are great ways to put yourself in prestigious positions, even if it's a small one. A small one that has some good exposure, and take on every assignment you can. And when you get that exposure, people see what you can do, and they can, you know, witness your work product and your articulation, and especially with international appeal, you will find in, you know, a year or two, you may be able to get some leverage out of it. Each board position I've sat on has taken me about a year or so to pay off, but most of them have paid off in some way. So, and committee, but even if it's not a board, a good organization will be helpful as well. And when you get an organization, get in a leadership role, because other people in other organizations, other businesses that are in that organization as well, and when they see what you can handle, what you can bring to the table, they'll seek you out. Any more questions?
Taking into consideration that we'll have probably a lot of our alumni join us by listening this workshop later, I'm thinking about many of them who have quite a few years of experience under their belt as a practicing attorneys, but have that love for international public interest and are interested in working for one of the international organizations. What would you suggest would be the best tactic or job strategy to kind of expose themselves to the international organization? How to open that first door and move from private to public?
So the first thing I recommend is to, again, join an organization. Department of State, for example, one of my clients, I pretty much work for them most of the time. They attend a lot of stuff. They're out there in the community a lot. And, you know, going to meetings and going to functions with them there is very helpful. The other thing I would tell you to do is, I got a call on a job a few days ago based on my LinkedIn profile. If you're not on LinkedIn, use your cyber abilities to your advantage. Get on LinkedIn, put an updated, current, detailed resume on LinkedIn, and recruiters will seek you out. I get a call, you know, once every couple of months, and you know, it's nice to get a call, and it's nice to, you know, have that type of discourse with them, because you get to feel the market out. What's the job paying? Where is it? What are they doing? You know, how much are you commanding in the market? So LinkedIn is a very, very good way to kind of put yourself out there without actually putting yourself physically out there. You can let this cyber world do it for you. The other thing, I was just talking about this to another group a few days ago, is to make sure that you attend as many meetings as you can in the community. You will find that people who are in these meetings, they shouldn't know what they do. I was in a meeting yesterday, and there's this senior guy from HUD in the meeting, and I'm looking to get them for a contract. So he and I are going to talk at some point in time.
HUD is?
Having a resident development. It's a gorilla when it comes to, you know, money and legal work and real estate and things of that nature. So just
putting yourself out there. You have to put yourself out there in the community to be able to have people find you. The other thing I'll say is take an entry-level job if you can. I mean, if there's no other way to get in, don't be like, well, I'm not the vice president or director, so I'm not going to go there. No, get in, showcase your abilities, you know, make sure you work your fingers to the bone, and the right people will notice. And it may take some time, but they'll notice, but you're in the door. Once you get in the door, you can knock on higher doors, but you can't knock on those doors till you get in the front door. So it may not be the job you want, but it gets you in, and when you get in, you can meet people, you can begin to network and make associations and make friends and make allies. Get as many public speaking opportunities as you can internally, lead trainings, lead workshops. One of the key things that companies look for is communication, writing and speaking. And if you can do that well, you'll be sought after. I mean, that's the reason why I got the Department of State contract, was because I had prior trainings that I had developed already, and they didn't want to pay for someone to charge them $300,000 to come to their trainings when they can just, you know, pay me. And that's how I got in. You know, having my communications already lined up in marketing for me. And that's what happens. And most of the clients that I get now, it's the same exact thing. It's because I either designed training for them, like the American Red Cross, or I talk with them about what they want to do in the future and how they want to conduct the trainings and then put it together for them in the future. So writing, communications, getting yourself out there, you know, be sure to get in the door and then do the rest.
Again, having in mind here the cohort who is here in the room, mostly LLM students, but also people who will be listening to it. What are your suggestions in regard to professional development? For example, we've learned from Christy and got a lot of information about additional skills that are absolutely necessary in order to enter the public sector kind of arena, including international public sector as well, from project management to grant management, fundraising, and so on. Is there any particular source of information you would recommend, or workshops to attend, or anything else that you have in mind that you think it's very important for either our 3Ls or someone who's a recent graduate to do in order to market themselves appropriately in public sector?
Right. There is way too much information out there for me to tell you where to approach it, but use the internet. Use the internet because the information is out there. You've got to look for it. Search for it, look for it, find it, and then use it. So I'll give you an example. One of the boards that I'm on was for a diversity conference, which we had in July in Orlando. So this woman was looking for people to coordinate. I know how to do it. We hooked up, and she asked me to join the board. So I said, fine, cool. Didn't pay very much at all. It actually was very small, but I chose it because it was going to be good exposure. I ended up emceeing the whole thing and leading the entire conference because everything was just so chaotic. And this is the first time doing it. I've been doing conferences for over 15 years. So I was telling them what to do. When they didn't believe me, and it happened, then they said, you take it over. So I did. I got three clients out of that function. It didn't pay anything really going in, but it paid coming out. And it paid because they saw who was really running the show. And I found that online. So you go out there in whatever field of law you're in, and if you guys are international students, you bring some great experience from the countries you lived in or traveled in to the table. People want that. We were in a much smaller world now than we were 20 years ago. So they want that. They want to know the language you speak, they want to know what countries you can work in, they want to know if you can write in these languages. And, you know, it's a skill that you can't just pick up. It's a skill that you have to pretty much either study for years and years and years or be born with it, which means that you're already in a category that
they can't get just off the street or, you know, in most classified ads or online job boards. Use the skills you have to find the organizations you want to join to make yourself successful in those organizations, and then just use that to keep springing yourself upward. Does that answer the question? Yeah. Should I just start picking on people? What's going on here? Yes.
So originally I just interned in the international organizations, and at the end of my internship, I actually attended a leading annual event and met a lot of people, wonderful people in that field. But after that, I find like I got a lot of connections, but they are like really far reaching for me because I'm just really fresh in that field. They are like the partners in different firms. So after that event, I just don't have an idea like how to reconnect them, like how to keep this contact. So do you have any suggestion for me, either help me to keep this connection and also help me a little bit for the job searching? Thank you.
That's a really good question. So when you're fresh out and you're looking for that first step into an organization or to a company, sometimes they say, well, they want folks with 5 to 7 years experience, something like that. And you're like, well, geez, how do I get that if no one will give it to me? The Department of State, like one of the departments that I do training for, they're engineers, and they want engineers with 7 years experience, but they won't hire fresh out of engineering school because they don't want to train them. So, the folks that do come there, they stay there for a few years, get their experience, and then leave. So there's no like succession planning, or there's no internship entry into the program. So to address your issue, the first thing you have to do is make sure you keep them, even if it's once or twice a year, just keep them in your contact list. You know, reach out to them for whatever reason, whether it's a holiday or you attended an event, they were on the event. I mean, if they're in an organization, I would join an organization. So if you know that they're like a chair of something or a vice president of some organization, I join it. The gap is to figure out how to get the experience, and I would ask them to mentor you. You know, so if they're willing to do so, it's a time commitment. See, mentorship is a time commitment on both sides, the mentor side and the mentee side. And if the mentor does it right, he or she should be really putting a lot of effort into seeing if you can succeed. But if you do it right as a mentee, you should be doing the work as much as you can up to that point, and then when it's time to see the mentor, you've already shown A, you can do all the work, and B, that you're willing to put a lot of effort into this mentorship. And in that way, they'll be like, well, this person has really got together. A, I can mentor them easily. It's not a lot of work to mentor them. And B, if this is the kind of work product they bring to the table, maybe I'll keep them in mind for a future, you know, position. Mentorship is a great way to really keep people that are very experienced and in whatever field that you're in, you know, highly rated in that field to help you out with whatever you're doing. I haven't had the fortune of having a good mentor, at least not consistently. Everyone that I had as a mentor, either when I got there, they resigned or retired. I'm like mentor, you know, like dead weight or something. I don't know what it is, but everything I've done, I've pretty much done on my own. But a mentor is an excellent way to get yourself further into the field you want to get into. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Sure.
Hi, I'm a Hubert Humphrey Fellow, and I'm from Zimbabwe. I just wanted to find out from you where you've gotten in life and what you've accomplished. Can you share some of the time management skills that you use, maybe subconsciously even? Because I find personally that there's so much more to do than time and energy that I have available. So I think these are one of the key skills that, you know, people must develop in order to actually succeed and progress in life.
So maybe if you could just share that with us, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. My first time management skill was, and that's the thing, is an 8-hour day. It's when you're on, either when you're really looking to get out there or achieve your goals or, you know, do a business, you're talking about 12, 14-hour days. Sorry, guys, that's the truth. I mean, I put in long days to accomplish what I need, because to your point, there's not enough time in an 8-hour day. So with that in mind, the other thing I would say is you have to prioritize. And basically, I have two or three different ways to prioritize. What can make the company money? What can set me up to make more money, which is a difference? And what do I need to make sure that my books and my accounting and my administration is all in order? Because if I'm not making money now, then it's a bust. If I'm not learning to make money in the future, then I'll make more money. But when that contract runs out, nothing is lined up. There's no pipeline. And for the third piece, if there's no, the admin is not smooth, if the books are not smooth, if, you know, everything else is not running smoothly, then eventually it'll all fall apart. So prioritizing is key. Now that's different for me as a business owner. For someone that's maybe a job seeker or someone that's looking to find a job or to advance in the job, the priorities that I've made in the past are to do whatever I can to make my boss successful, make them look good. That's my priority. And if you make them look good, they'll take care of you. They'll be like, ooh, I want her. Yeah, she's coming with me. They will pull you along with you. Okay, and that's what you want. That's kind of like the mentor thing. You know, people will pull people with them. They will support them, and they will, because, you know, good help is hard to find. It's a very common quote, but it's also very true. And, you know, if you are making them look good, they always want to look good. So that's your job. Your job description is now make the boss look good, not so much, you know, attorney at law. The second thing I would do as either a new employee or a job searcher is to make sure that you have a full pot of stuff to do in different areas. So for example, when I was looking for a job, I had 5 resumes. I had a resume for law, a resume for training, a resume for executive experience, a resume for diversity, and a resume for HR. And when I applied for different jobs, I picked the resume I want to send to them because that's what they were looking for, and I send it out. And I did that because when you're looking at a resume, when they're looking at a resume, they only spend about a minute or two scanning over, and you either get in the yes pile or the long no pile. And you have to maximize that time, so the keywords, the key assignments, the key phrases they're looking for that particular job, even if they would be lower down in a different resume, you put them higher up, that makes it look more important, that gives you a better look on the resume. Now, you're not telling any falsehoods, you're just reorganizing your information. And you'd be surprised how much that can actually, you know, help you out in the process. So keeping your resume up to date is also extremely key because, you know, all of them for me up to date. Because, you know, you never know when it's going to come in handy. When someone says, shoot me your resume, you're going to be like, dang, now I got to write my resume all over again. It's been, you know, 2-3 days doing it, as opposed to doing it for, you know, an hour or two every couple of months when you get a new assignment or you get a new accomplishment. And being able to quickly spruce it up and shoot it out in no time flat. Does that answer your question? Sure.
I'm curious about how your linking look like, because you have 5 resumes in different fields, right?
Excellent question. I just picked the most standardized one. So the one I have for LinkedIn is it's probably my legal resume. And then, you know, when I get the call on that, like for example, what headhunter has called me 3 times? The first time they called me was for, I forget the job, but it wasn't really my speed, so okay. The second time they called was for a different job based on the same LinkedIn resume. And I was like, nah, it wasn't a good fit. So they called me again a third time a week or so ago, and this job's actually a really good fit. Now, am I going to take it? Probably not. But I'm just going through the motions because, you know, I want to see what's going on there in the market right now. I have not looked for a job in 5 years. I haven't had a need to. But you're always going to keep your skills sharp. And keeping them sharp is how you can ace interviews and make sure your data looks good. And she gave me some feedback. Feedback from a recruiter, very good feedback. So I'm not too experienced to take any feedback from anybody, because everyone's got something that is a different perspective, a different look, a fresher look, and I will incorporate at least some part of what I'm recommended to make myself and my presentation and my work product a better one.
I have a question. It's working?
What are some of the skill sets that you've had that were really key or pivotal for you to be able to transition from the public sector into the private sector and then back into the public sector? I think working, especially for the U.S. government, is very daunting. USA Jobs just throws everybody off. And how to market yourself to a government audience, to show them that you have the skills that they are looking for, is something that a lot of people seem to have issues with. So what would you say is the best way to approach that?
So when I was an attorney for State of Connecticut, practicing labor and employment law, discrimination law, really, and I was trying cases, I was mediating cases, adjudicating cases, I was interfacing with businesses all the time. There were the respondents to the plaintiffs who were coming and saying that they were discriminated against as employers. And as I did my job, within about 6 to 9 months, you know, a couple of them said, well, a couple of employers said, well, what are you doing here? What do you want to do next? Uh-oh, some feelings going out now. And I was, I'm fine here, I'm happy here. As about another year or two went by, and the request got a little more earnest, you know, I began to listen to them. And one woman, she probably had about 5 or 6 cases in front of me over the years, said, we want to hire you as our HR attorney. Will you come in for an interview? So sure, it couldn't hurt. So when you're in a government position, interfacing with private employers, you're on an interview all the time, because they are potential employers for you, and they are always looking to get someone that's good into their organization. By the time I had gone there, I had already met about 8 or 10 of their managers, because they had to testify in front of me. I already knew, you know, half of their HR team. So I was like, first day I was like, hey everybody, I'm the guy that used to, you know, try your cases, and now I'm here. But I realized that it was because I had worked so well in the job I was in with the government that I was pulled to a job in the private sector. And then, for the next job, I was on a board, again with the board, it's a diversity board, and a larger company, United Technologies, their director of diversity, and an attorney was on the regional board, and they saw my work there, and they were like, well, why don't you come and join us? Well, okay, so I became an attorney for them. The best thing you can do to get from a public sector job to a government job really depends on the kind of job you're in. If you're interfacing with the private sector, knock it out the park every time. If you are not interfacing with the private sector, make sure that that's happening in your LinkedIn profile. Make sure that your accomplishments are up to date. Make sure that, you know, in your organizations that you're joining, everyone here should be at least part of 1 or 2 organizations. If you're not, you're selling yourself short. You're losing opportunities. If you're sitting here waiting for someone to call you back, you're not doing your job as a job searcher. You need to be out there. You need to be meeting with people, shaking hands. Even if your business card says American University LLM, you need to be putting that information out there, because that's where the jobs are. The U.S. government is a very peculiar beast. And I say this because this is two words
that make it very, very difficult to get into U.S. government. Veterans preference. And I was giving a speech with a couple of ambassadors about 2 or 3 years ago, and I was in front of this huge audience at this, it was an NAACP meeting. And when the job issue came out, the audience was like revved up, because they were like, I didn't get callbacks, and I have like 30 jobs that apply for USA jobs, and no one calls me back, and so on and so forth, and you know, how can I get around that? So, okay, how many of you are veterans? No one raised their hand. That's the first issue. Veterans and special disabled veterans get points for applying for a U.S. government job. And that puts you immediately behind the eight ball, because you don't get any points, unless any of you are special disabled veterans that I don't know about. So then the second issue is, there has to be qualified for the job, but it's a very high bar to rule out a special disabled veteran or a veteran for a job in the U.S. government. There are exceptions, however, and one of them is attorneys. So the attorneys do get around, and doctors do get around veterans' preference. However, a lot of the lawyer jobs that are posted, I would say 9 times out of 10, the lawyer job is already being designed for someone that's already in there. So you're now maybe sideswiped or sidestepped veterans' preference, but you now are dealing with the cherry picking of the people that are in the department. You know, with someone approached me recently about some advice on how to get in the government, their attorney, and they said, well, I want to come in as a 13. Ooh, no, it's not going to happen. Not with such little experience. Look to come in at a 9 or an 11. Maybe a 12 if you're lucky, but you know, it can, don't get discouraged. It can take some time. The other thing you can do is go through a third-party contractor. Now that's a key option for you. There are third-party contractors out there, and different third-party contractors have different skill sets that they provide to the government. So some is, the biggest one's IT. If you're like law and IT, you're pretty much golden, because they're always looking for IT. Some of them are like construction, some of them are translations, others involve national security, et cetera, et cetera. So if you can find a third-party contractor that will take you on their role, market you to the government, and then you go in as a third-party contractor, guess what you are now? You're in the door. Okay? You have no benefits. You have no retirement. You may have some paydays off based on your third-party employer, but not based on the government. But you're in the door. And you go in there, and you knock it out the park. And I have seen people personally go from third-party contractor to either an independent contractor when they get a W-2, and or they go on as a full hire. So it happens. It happens a lot. The issue is getting in the door. And getting to a third-party contractor, just go online and search for U.S. government contractors in whatever field that you want to look into, and see what pops up, and call them. They are, and it won't be like calling to get into the government, because they want you. You know what you are to them? You're money. I mean, they will sell you out. Well, not sell you out, but they will contract you out to the government for $75 an hour, but they're making probably $135, and they're keeping that slice, and you're getting a 75 slice. So to you, to them, you're money. So they will take your call, especially if you have the qualifications for whatever you're looking for. I will also say a lot of third-party contractors look for people that can travel. So if you're not afraid to go to Kabul or to Japan or to any part of Africa, they'll look for you, because that's when the pickings get slim. Yeah, I want that job, but I don't want to leave the U.S. Well, then guess what? We don't need you in this position. But if you're willing to travel or relocate for a period of time, they'll take care of you. Did I ask a question?
Yeah. You got another one?
No. No.
From your perspective, for our 2Ls and 3Ls, for example, if they're interested in public interest or maybe international public interest overall, but they just cannot make up their minds, what is the topic of their interest? Like, they haven't set their hearts yet. What have you seen recently being the hot topics of public interest? I know it's a hard question really to put your hand on one or few, but what have you seen as hot topic that might land you a job if you become really active, proactive as well, becoming a member of professional associations, start speaking, and what should I speak about, right? What is the hot topic?
Okay, other questions? I have seen in state and in other agencies, one of the hot topics right now is cyber law. With the pirating that's going on and the breaching of firewalls and the worms and the Trojan horses, they want to know what are their legal ramifications and their legal remedies. Oftentimes, it's so difficult to enforce because the people that are doing this, they're outside the jurisdiction, number one, and two, they're almost impossible to find. So they got to go on a huge FBI, CIA, NSA, and then hunt to find them. But knowledge about the internet, and knowledge about cyber law is right now, I'd say, one of the hottest legal topics that you can really get associated with. The other that's really big is, and it's always big, but international relations, I mean, you're in the right school for it, is really big as well, because they're becoming problematic in some places. And when they become problematic, guess who they call? Lawyers. And if you have either diplomatic experience or knowledge of that law or knowledge of that country, especially if you speak the language, you could be pretty effective for them. Other than that, when it comes to international public law, I would say stick with your strengths. So if your strengths are knowledge about a certain country, it may be a niche market, but the riches are on the niches. That's what they always say in business. If you throw out a general service, you may get one or two bites. But if you throw out a niche service and Pearson really wants you, you'll be gold to them. And they will treat you well because you're giving them a service that very few folks can provide. So no matter what it is, no matter what country it's from, no matter what subsect it is, use your niche experience to market yourself. And what also that will do is that will keep you from taking a job that you wouldn't want to be happy in. Because if you take a job doing something for, an area outside of expertise, you take it because you got to pay the rent. Understood. That happens. But if you take a job in something you know and love, you'll be probably happier there than a general job where you're just reading contracts or looking over construction documentation. When I was in law school, like a lot of my friends, they went to big law firms, and they were miserable. They got what they called the golden handcuffs. And because they were making so much money to not pay the egregious Columbia Law School loans. So they were stuck there for 10 years, and they were miserable. I went the public interest route, and I had loan forgiveness, so I never got golden handcuffs. I wasn't making six figures, but it gave me experience that they weren't getting, because they were stuck in rooms, just reading reams of paper for God knows how long. And that's not the route that makes you marketable, and it's not the route that makes you successful, at least not in my mind. It basically, you're just a filling machine for a law firm. Having that experience, a specialized experience that you guys all have, is what really will make you successful in those positions. But cyber law is pretty hot. That's your question?
Thank you. Yes, I'm sorry. It's not that I want to take all the questions here.
just trying, as a person who is from Korean professional development office here at the school, trying to remember all these questions that I usually get from our students, and especially these who are not here and represented but will be listening. I actually do have another question. You took the path of public interest, right, lawyer, but maybe not necessary, at least that's not the part that we were reading in the bio, taking the opportunity of some of the honor programs. Would you recommend that as a great way also to enter the door of the federal government, because we support our 2 and 3Ls to participate in many of these honor programs? I know that's not a full-time job immediately, but it's, at least it's a way to put your foot in the federal government and have that on your resume. Would you say that's something very important to have on your resume as well?
It is, because, you know, when it comes down to 4 or 5 different resumes and looking at, you're going to look at something that's going to differentiate you from everybody else. The main differentiator is if you know somebody. That's the main one. The second one is if they can identify with something that you have done or a place you lived or school you went to. So, for example, if someone that was a Columbia alum saw my resume, they said, oh, let's put this guy on the side because he could be something. But the third is the achievements, the accolades you received, you know, what you've done in the community. Those are all key with how you can differentiate yourself from other candidates. The other thing I'll say, I gave a speech on this last week with social media. Be careful what you put on social media, please. Okay, so pictures with you slamming down beer bongs on a hat on the beach in Del Rey, you know, with a bunch of your friends, not cool for a job search. I didn't bring the stats to me, but 3 out of 5 employers look for social media information when they're looking at candidates. And 50% of them have had either input or rejected an employee or an applicant because of what's on social media. And you do not want to social media yourself out of a job before you even get to the interview or after the first interview. So the first thing I teach when I talk about social media, that's actually a little class that I teach, social media and law, is there's an inherent struggle between security and accessibility. The more accessible things are, the less secure they are. And the more secure, the less accessible. What you want to do is find that balance for you. I mean, you can have the big three, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. LinkedIn usually is okay. Usually you don't find that kind of stuff on LinkedIn. But now it's Instagram as well. And you will see pictures on there that you will not believe. And not just that, but you will find that even if you took a picture, not thinking it was going to go anywhere, next thing you know, guess what? You're tagged on Facebook. And that means that anybody can see it based on your privacy settings, either friends only, friends of friends, or the entire universe. So here you are, struggling to find a job, doing all the things, getting on boards, going to organizations, but you go have your fun. No problem with that. Okay? Don't let your fun wind up on Facebook. Don't let it wind up on Instagram. Because you know what? Everything's accessible now. And that has been an issue. I mean, I've personally seen it happen where people, you know, felt that either they weren't going to hire them because they were, you know, inappropriately dressed or doing crazy things on Facebook or Instagram or saying stupid stuff on Twitter. And it's called, and I've seen read lawsuits where, you know, someone's teleworking that day, and the next thing you know, they're, you know, at the beach having a good old time. And the boss is like, well, wait a minute, did this employee be teleworking today? Why is he at the beach? And there have been, you know, a number of suits based on that, and people that have been fired because they just liked something or they wrote a comment to something. They were even the original commenter. They liked it or they wrote a comment about it. And that has cost them their job. Now, one of the cases, one of the ones that are coming up through the ranks is, you know, they got the job back. But still, to go through all that, to get an attorney, to litigate a case in front of the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, it's not fun. It's So if you're not engaged in that practice in the first place, you can find a job easier. You're putting down a barrier that you would put up if you didn't do it in the first place. And then you would get the job. You wouldn't lose it if you didn't do something untoward or unwise on Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter or Instagram. So, and that's another area of law to your earlier question. That area of law is actually really hot right now. Really hot. When I say cyber law, I was referring more so to hacking and the technology piece, but the social media side is really going gangbusters in the legal field and labor and employment law. I never would have predicted, you know, 6 years ago this is going to be a big push in the labor and employment law side, but guess what? It is. And, you know, when I read those cases, I'm like, man, who would have thought that Facebook would bust your job? But it happens. It's happening. Question? So go home today and look at your Facebook. And go read your tweets and go your Instagram. And if you have a friend that puts something on there, call your friend and have them take it off. I wish I was kidding, but I am not. That, listen, if you want to maintain this friendship, take down the picture of me when I had a momentary lapse of sanity and did something, and then you said it was cute, click, and it's on Facebook. Ask them to take it down. Another question.
So, like, what are your suggestion on using a recruiter? Like, how we should approach them, or just, you know, sending out the resume, put our resume online, or just waiting for a call?
So that's a good question. My first recommendation for using a recruiter is find the one that's in your field. Different recruiters have different lanes they stay in. There's IT lanes, actually even sub-IT lanes. You know, there's like for me, there's the HR and labor and legal lanes. So actually I'm in a couple different lanes. There's lanes for you know, the international languages, things of that nature. There's lanes for mechanical engineers. So if you guys have a different degree other than a law degree and you want to combine the two, you can try and find a recruiter in that particular space. Because what you find is, if you just call the recruiter in general, they say, well, we don't really do that type of recruiting. So the first thing you want to do is find the kind of recruiter in the kind of field you want. The second thing I would do is ask your friends who have similar skills if they have a recruiter and use them. Because that's going to give you what? A reference. And if your friend used the recruiter and your friend will vouch for you, you will now get more attention from that recruiter because they have someone that vouches for you. I didn't even realize it, but the recruiter that called me, and we had a discussion about it a few days ago, she never told me where she got my name from, but when she asked for my details of my history, and I told her my prior boss's name, she goes, oh, that's right, that's where I got your name from. And I was like, really, he gave you my name? And now this guy was, he was impossible to read. He was like looking at Stonehenge. I mean, he was this total, like, just rock. So it surprised me that he gave her my name, but it made her call me. So getting a reference from someone that knows the recruiter is actually a very, very good reference to use. The other thing that I'll say is, don't be afraid to send a recruiter a resume, even cold. I mean, they're not the employer. And they're looking to make money as well. And to them, all of you are money. When you get placed, sometimes they get even up to your salary to place them. So, you know, don't be afraid to approach a recruiter because, you know, they'll if they want you, they'll take you on. And if they don't get a match for you in that one job, they will keep you in mind. Just like me when I had 3 calls from this one recruiter. The other thing I'll say about recruiters is
listen to what they have to say. If they give you feedback on your resume, take it. Even if you're making one specially designed for that particular job or that particular position, take their advice. Because they want to know that you can listen to feedback and comments as opposed to not, and then they don't want to place someone that's going to be a hard fit or a hard head into that position. So, you know, the changes that she advised me to make, I guess I'm fine. Didn't even think twice about it. Personally, I wouldn't do it otherwise, but for her, I would. There are, and I haven't seen any recently, but I know there are like some recruiting books out there that like have listed recruiters in various states and organizations, and maybe online. So you may be able to find a resource like that to kind of help you, you know. But the first thing I would do is to ask any one of your friends if they know a recruiter. Sure.
If there aren't any more questions, I have. So if there aren't any more questions, I just have a couple last thoughts maybe to add. Again, take a look at the trainings and workshops on the final page of your packet, because those organizations, this is not an exhaustive list, but this is just kind of a good place to start if you're interested in any of the topics that we've discussed, and good places to go for more resources. Again, Google, Twitter, those are great places to just start looking for things. If you're looking for templates, looking for resources, looking for how-tos, there's tons and tons and tons of information out there, so you're never going to need to reinvent the wheel on any of this stuff. And then I definitely wanted to reinforce some of the things that Eric has said. The importance of networking is absolutely crucial. So full disclosure here, I actually got laid off about a year and a half ago from a previous employer. They lost a grant, they didn't get money to continue working on the project that I was working on, so they had to lay me off. It was a horrible thing. They loved me, I loved working there, but didn't have money to keep me on board. So I created several versions of my resume, started asking everyone I knew to help me with my job search. And people were great about helping me, putting me in touch with their colleagues, even just informational interviews, saying, you should go and talk to this person or at this organization because they might be able to give you some suggestions. It wasn't like I was walking in and asking for a job. I was just going in and asking them, what do you do? Who are some of the other people in this field that I should talk to? What has helped you get to this place in your career? What are some of the skill sets that you've developed that have really helped you here? And it wasn't a long conversation, but I was able to say, this is the kind of stuff that I'm interested in doing. This is my background. What would you recommend that I do in my job search? I had, so it took me 4 months of job searching to find the job that I have now. In that 4 months, I had 27 interviews. Those were not informational interviews. Those were job interviews. I had 27 interviews, and out of them, I got several job offers and got the job that I have now. And again, some of those were multiple interviews. With, you know, I had 5 interviews to get the job that I have now. Another organization had like 6, you know, before I got a job offer. So some of them, you know, are multiple times over. You got to meet with everybody from HR all the way to the executive of the organization before you get the offer. But again, the fact that I got so many job interviews was totally because of my network. And hand in hand with that, like Eric said, getting involved with organizations in the field. I have belonged to the American Society of International Law since I was a law student, and have been involved with the Women in International Law interest group because that's my area of interest, but there are 15 other interest groups of every imaginable area of international law you could possibly imagine. Get involved, sign up as a member. I put some handouts on the table. Because you guys are students or alums of AU, which is a partner organization, you get a discount on membership, and joining any of their interest groups is free. The Society for International Development, there's a million organizations out there. While you're a student, the rate to join is very, very cheap. So get involved if at all possible, because those are great ways to make connections, to get in the field, to figure out who the major players are, and to just ask for advice. You know, don't be afraid to ask for coffee. I go out for informational interviews and coffees with people several times a month. I kind of have a limit because I get a lot of requests, but if I'm available, I will do it. Particularly for WCL students, I do it all the time because it's really important to me to give back to my school. And as Eric said, when you know, sorting through that, when I'm recruiting and sorting through that pile, if it's an AU student, they almost always go in the look further pile. Mostly because I know what the quality of education is, I know who the professors are, I know what you are learning in your classes, and I know that the content of what you're learning is going to be directly applicable to the job that I'm hiring for. So it's a great way to get your foot in the door, is to connect with the alumni. And also mentoring. Mentoring is really, really important. I have been exceptionally grateful for fantastic mentors in my life, many of whom have directly contributed to my career path and the opportunities that I've been given. My old boss was one of the best mentors that I've had, and so when I was laid off, she directly connected me to several organizations that were hiring and literally shoved me through the front door to say, hire this person if at all possible because she's fantastic, and I've worked with her, and I know she'll be great. And I actually had to call people, you know, that were friends of Cindy's at the last minute and be like, well, I know I'm kind of halfway through the hiring process, but I already got another job offer. I actually called one of the organizations that I was several interviews into the interview process with today to say, I loved you guys, loved your organization. I'm actually organizing a panel on something that you guys do every day, and I would love to get one of your staff people to come in and talk on the panel. And they were like, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, it's been a year and a half. And you still remember us. You were, you know, it was a great relationship during the interview process. So I was able to pick up the phone easily and call up their HR person and say, who do you have that I could reach out to? Keeping that connection. Because if I ever want to look for another job, that organization is still on my list of places I would consider working. And if you can kind of maintain those relationships, it's a great way to, you know, keep your foot in the door, go out for coffee. Even if you've got a job and you're not looking, meet with people. Sometimes the best way to develop those relationships is to figure out ways that you can work together. I love working with my friends. You know, my friends that have worked with Amnesty International or Physicians for Human Rights, even Susanna here at the War Crimes Research Office, we get together all the time and say, what can we do together? Because we've got some areas of common work or interest, and let's do something creative. It's a great way to broaden your connection and your networks. Also, while you're a student and you have the ability, or even if you're not, do volunteer works. I know Eric volunteers on a lot of boards. I also do quite a bit of volunteer work with ASIL, with the Women in International Law Interest Group, because now I'm the co-chair. We actually started a mentoring program last year, which is now in its second year, and so I spend a lot of time doing volunteer work with various organizations that I'm passionate about, and it also gives you some great job skills. If you want to volunteer to write some grant proposals or do some program implementation because they don't have the money to hire program staff, it's a great way to just build up your resume. And then finally, I wanted to let you guys know, I mean, obviously, in addition to AFL being a great organization, they actually published a book about a year ago on careers in international law. It's a guidebook. And it gives a lot of really great advice. There's advice in here for 2Ls, 1 year, 1Ls, 2Ls, and 3Ls, as well as LLM students. It's not as specific in some of the tools that we've talked about over the last 2 days, but it does give a lot of really great advice, and you can order a copy on their website. And I have a copy here if you want to just flip through it and take a look.
We have a few of those.
Oh, great.
Library.
And there are several copies in the OCPD library. So go and check them out because it is a really great resource. And of course, if you want to sign up as a member, you get to attend a lot of their events for free. I got quite a few great connections out of ASIL events where I just went and talked to the people who were attending because they were doing things that were of similar interest to stuff that I was interested in when I was an LLM student. And seriously, while you're an LLM student, this is perfect time for you to be doing that kind of work. Go to every single event in town that you can, meet as many people as you can, apply for fellowships, apply for scholarships, apply for, you know, postgraduate work. ASIL has a great fellowship program, the Helton Fellowship Program, that allowed me to go and work in Morocco for a summer after I graduated. You're not going to get that kind of an opportunity again, other than while you're a student. So definitely take advantage of those things. And even on main campus, there's an office on main campus that helps students apply for postgraduate fellowships. So there's lots of different resources out there, and Melania and her team have tons and tons and tons more resources.
I know we're going to put a lot of this, a lot of these documents online afterwards, so you're not going to have to reinvent the wheel if you want to learn how to put a budget together or some of these other documents, because it's a lot of work. So if you have any other questions, please let us know. But we're happy to stay after and talk to you guys more if you're interested.
So, any more questions? Listen, it was great talking with you. I wish you all the best of luck in your career. You never know what's going to happen until it happens with your career, so just keep an open mind and keep all your options open and make sure that you choose the one that's best for you, both short-term and long-term, because if you have that option, you know, it'll be a better choice for you, you know, all around. So. If you need to contact me, you can contact through Chris through your school, and then, you know, I can respond as best I can. All right, thank you.
I want to thank you both, to you, Eric and Christy, for dedicating your time, your busy time, to join us here. And in the name of the students who will be listening this later and everyone else, I mean, thank you so much for incredible information, tips, advices, expertise that you shared. I'm going to invite all the students who are here today to take the opportunity to network with Eric and Christy right now and also during the embassy reception that I hope you'll be able to attend, which takes place another hour or so. And then let's check how our students are actually taking all the advices in regard to LinkedIn. I hope they will actually ask you to be a friend very soon.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.